From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Later on, remote viewer Dr. Doom, Ed Dames, joins us. Here's what's happening. A preliminary examination of the cell phones and computers used by those brothers has found no indication of an accomplice in the Boston Marathon bombing. The source stressed that the investigation's still ongoing, but Bureau officials at this point appear increasingly confident that nobody else was involved. Johar has told investigators that he and his brother acted alone, learned to build the pressure cooker bombs over the internet, and were motivated by a desire to defend Islam because of the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Meanwhile, hackers compromised Twitter accounts of the Associated Press, sending out a false tweet about an attack at the White House. The false tweet said that there had been two explosions at the White House and that President Barack Obama was injured. The AP confirmed that its Twitter account has been suspended following a hack and that it was working to correct the issue. Again, it was a false situation. Charges against the Mississippi man accused of sending ricin-tainted letters to President Barack Obama and other officials, they were dropped, citing new information had been uncovered. He might have been framed. We'll find out soon enough. The Obama administration challenging an Israeli intelligence assessment that Bashar al-Assad's Syrian regime has attacked rebels with sarin or other toxic substances. Now, while the U.S. administration has said that the Syrian government's use of chemical weapons would cross a red line, Secretary of State John Kerry has said that they have not seen conclusive evidence that Syria's government has deployed chemical weapons in that country's civil war. Jerome Corsi, noted author, let's check in with him. Jerry, first of all, if chemical weapons are being used, that's going to be a huge problem for the Assad government.
It will be a game changer, George. There's no doubt about it. If there's absolutely conclusive proof that the Assad government is using sarin chemical weapons, the Obama administration has said that would be a red line and it would virtually force U.S. military action. But that proof is not yet there.
There's some talk, Jerry, that the rebels include a lot of members of al-Qaeda. What do you hear?
Increasingly, I think they do. I think the reports I'm getting, certainly from the expatriates that have left Libya and are today at various places in the Middle East, are saying that al-Qaeda elements have gone through Turkey into Syria and may have even brought weapons that were provided by the Obama administration through Benghazi. But again, these reports are just in the process of being confirmed.
All right, Jerry, thank you so much. Jerry's work also can be seen on WorldNet Daily. Near Providence, Rhode Island, the body of a man believed to be in his 20s discovered in the water off India Point Park in the area opposite the Wyndham Garden Hotel. A commander out there says it appears the man was in his 20s, but since he was in the water for some time, it's difficult to say for certain. Asked if the body might be of Sunil Tripathi, the missing Brown University student last seen a month ago. The official said he didn't want to speculate. Tripathi did disappear a month ago without his wallet, and of course there was no ID on this body. An analysis of more than 33,000 cases of foodborne illness shows that ground beef and chicken have caused more hospitalizations than any other meats. The report by the Center for Science and Public Interest said chicken nuggets, ham, sausage pose the lowest risk of foodborne illnesses, but that ground beef and chicken are the highest. An inch of rain doesn't sound like a lot, does it? But in the parts of the flooded Midwest, it's enough to make a bad situation worse. In Illinois, residents braced for the extra inch that will delay any reduction in floodwaters that have ravaged dozens of counties there, forcing thousands of residents from their homes. As rivers across the heartland swell during the past couple weeks, rising water blamed now for 4 deaths. Flooding threatens rivers in Illinois, Missouri, Iowa, Indiana, North Dakota, Mississippi, and Michigan. Let's check in with the head of EarthChangesMedia.com, Mitch Batras. Mitch, what was once a drought last year seems to be on the other end this year. Why?
Well, it's the fluctuations in the jet stream, and what's causing that is a magnetic flux. And when you go behind that, again, we're at the sun. Now, cycle 24 has been less than many cycles. However, the potency of each solar flare, whether it be a C-class or M-class, which, by the way, we've had some the largest M-class flare of this cycle occurred just 2 weeks ago. It was a M6.5. All this plays a role. But what we're seeing today is still not records. The Great Flood of 1927 has still not been met. It topped levels of 56.2 feet along the Mississippi River. So what's happening today is bad, especially if you're living in that area. But I believe it's probably because of population. 1937, known as the Great Flood of 1937. This was the Ohio River. 385 people dead.
Jeez.
It's been going on. So I say this to for us to realize that there are cycles, and there are cycles among cycles. Of course, we talk about the 30s droughts. So speaking of drought, we knew it as the Dust Bowl. So I think these cyclical things are occurring, some which are expanded. In other words, we know of the 100-year flood, but we know very little about the 1,000-year flood or the 5,000-year flood. I think that's what we're seeing, and unfortunately, there's a lot more people.
The planet continues to change. Thank you, Mitch. Mitch's website you'll find on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. You know, after 6 months of research by leading scientists at Stanford University, the Atacama humanoid remains an incredible mystery. If you go to coasttocoastam.com, you'll see a trailer for the incredible documentary, the Sirius documentary, and also some more information. We are going to be talking about this humanoid in a moment with Dr. Stephen Greer and Paula Harris next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. I've got to tell you, in the history of my broadcast career, this story is one of the most riveting I have ever witnessed. The mummified remains of what looks like a little six-inch being of some type is turning the Sirius documentary into probably one of the most eagerly awaited documentaries. It was previewed yesterday in Los Angeles, created, of course, by Stephen Greer, who has been a guest on Coast to Coast in the past. And, of course, Paula Harris has been working with Stephen on this incredible documentary. We're going to spend the next couple hours talking about this issue. A little bit later on, we're going to be joined for a moment by one of the researchers who, too, is baffled by this incredible situation. First of all, let me bring in Paula Harris. You all know her. She's the Italo-American photojournalist, investigative reporter in the field of extraterrestrial-related phenomena. Paula, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing well, George. Good evening.
Looking forward to this. This is exciting. And you were at the preview last night, the premiere?
I was at the premiere, and that was exciting. I've never seen that much anticipation for something, and we were absolutely thrilled it just far exceeded all of our expectations. That's what everyone said.
Tip of the iceberg, Paul. It's going to grow. It's going to get even more in demand, I think. Let's bring in Dr. Stephen Greer, of course, founder of the Disclosure Project, the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence. We call it CSETI. And, of course, the Orion Project and Sirius Technology Advanced Research. Stephen has been a regular contributor to Coast to Coast. I haven't had him on in about 4.5 years. Stephen, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. I'm here in Los Angeles and recovering from a great night.
It was. You were very busy yesterday. Very busy
indeed.
Stephen, first of all, good to have you back. And tell me a little bit, if you can, about this little, I'll call it a creature, for lack of a better word or phrase, and then we'll get into the Sirius documentary and then Paula's involvement. Tell me about this humanoid figure.
Yes, well, we have determined, of course, it's a 6-inch or 13-centimeter body. It's an intact body. It is not a hoax. We've done CAT scans and X-rays and DNA testing. It is an actual organism. And it was found in the Atacama Desert of Chile in 2003. I did not see it until 2009. and was one of the few people to have ever held it in my hands, and I knew instantly that it was something very unusual. I can tell you from the reports that once we got access to it back in September 2012, about 6 or 8 months ago, and I was able to take clippings from the right anterior ribs, and we could see there was bone marrow in there. And then we saw the CAT scans and saw the lungs as well as what is the remains of a heart in the chest cavity, that we were dealing with something extraordinary. But it wasn't until we got the report at Stanford University from Dr. Ralph Lockman, who is the world's expert on skeletal abnormalities and defects, and literally wrote the textbook on it. And he said, look, according to the bone density and epiphyseal plate development, which are the growth plates in the legs, this is a 6 to 8 year old human-like being. And to be 6 inches big and 6 to 8 years old, that becomes a dispositive and astonishing thing, no matter what the genetics show, because the genetics, of course, we don't have a database of ET genetics, and we don't have a database of non-human but human-like creature genetics. So this is going to be a multi-year genetic research project, but the preliminary results even on that are, quite frankly, somewhat baffling. Although, I have to say, we are all not saying this is ET. We're saying we don't know what it is.
Right.
It's a legitimate organism. And if you go to SiriusDisclosure.com, you're going to see that there is a very large report we just put up, and there's a link to it on our website, SiriusDisclosure.com, where we have the actual signed report from Dr. Lockman, the preliminary report from Dr. Gary Nolan of Stanford also, as well as the actual CAT scan images and x-rays that anyone in the world can see. So it's there for anyone who wants to look at it.
And what's so amazing about this, Stephen, as you pointed out, it's 6 to 8 years old, possibly. And for a moment, when
let me correct you. The world's expert on skeletal dysplasias, as well as the head of the Manchon Clinic in Barcelona, where we did the x-rays, have all concluded it is not a fetus. Now, Siegel at Huffington Post wrote, oh, well, there are people who said it's a fetus that's been was deformed. Absolutely not a fetus. And this is from the world's experts. I can say that for certain it is not a fetus. And moreover, you look at the mandible, it has a mature tooth left in it. Well, you know, you don't have a 15 to 20-year-old fetus with mature teeth that chew their ways out of a womb. So this is something that is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, whatever it was stayed alive for 6 to 8 years in that very miniature stage, right?
Yeah, yes. And what's amazing, you know, I'm an emergency and trauma doctor, and I have delivered premature infants. I have delivered an anencephalic deformed baby that didn't live many hours. I have delivered very tiny infants and been in the neonatal intensive care units where we have resuscitated the babies. Never have I seen a 6-inch tiny, fragile baby, even at the time of birth, be able to live for any number of hours that would be this size, never mind for 6 years. And you can look, and what we have put up on our website are the growth plates of what humans look like, and then the CAT scans and x-rays of this being. And anyone who has any scientific and medical training will say, look, this is absolutely not a fetus.
Let's bring Paula Harris in now. Paula, you had a chance to look at the documentary last night, extremely well done, something that people in the UFO field strongly need right now. Your reaction to this little creature?
Oh, well, the little creature is part of the documentary. It's woven into the documentary, and it just shows that that there's a lot of anomalies in the universe, and it's important that we look at it scientifically. And what's amazing is that Dr. Greer, throughout it, the whole entire film, has a Stanford University crew and their results throughout the entire film. But I think the documentary itself, what it does, is it gives a 360-degree look at the UFO field, the UFO cover-up, the government cover-up, the lies that have been given to us and humanity by the powers that be. It has testimony from the Disclosure Project, the little being is just part of an incredible amount of evidence.
That's true. Right?
Incredible.
Go ahead, Steve.
Right, and one of the things I want to point out is that, you know, what's in this film is sort of a portal, not for the UFO aficionados and enthusiasts so much, but for the general public, because, you know, at this premiere, we had some of the largest executives in Hollywood there. We had Matt Bodine there. We had, you know, Thomas Jane. We had a lot of A-list celebrities and others. And this is creating quite a bit of interest, but we also had a large number of executives and high-tech people who have been viewing this weekend. And, you know, I was at Paul Abdul's house, and we were doing a screening, and there were some of the most amazing people in the Los Angeles area there in a private screening with Paul Abdul and myself and Dr. Nolan. And you know, it's really something where people are beginning to question, my God, what if this is true? What if we have been visited? What if there are advanced technologies that are being kept secret that have kept us on fossil fuels for more than half a century? And what a crime against the Earth and humanity that is. So this is really what we want to do. We want to increase awareness. And I just want to point out that the proceeds of this film are all going into a new energy research fund, because what we really want to do is move from information or speculation into a serious, pun intended perhaps, technology research and development effort where we can put the most brilliant scientists in the world that I've identified over the last 22 years and build up these alternative energy systems that we know and can prove exist.
Well, and as
I've got to build them in the three dimensions.
As I've known you over the years, Stephen, you have been really working at trying to learn more about these propulsion systems that these apparent craft have been, you know, coming back and forth from. And you're right. I mean, there's no, people think that, oh, they can't get here because they think of it in conventional terms. They've got something we don't have right now.
Well, maybe Lockheed Skunk Works has it.
Yeah.
And one of the people in the movie talks about how he was at a meeting with Ben Rich, the head of Lockheed Skunk Works, who showed an image of a black disc that was made by us going out into space. And Ben Rich said, we have the technologies and the means to take E.T. home. And he was quoting from the head of the Lockheed Skunk Works, and that's in the film.
Stephen, as you said, you know, you have been a doctor for years. It's been your career. You've left that to pursue your interest now in extraterrestrial intelligence. That's pretty gutsy on your part. What made you do this?
To be honest with you, I realized when it came to me very clearly back in the 90s that the government wasn't going to be able to disclose this information because the government of we the people were being lied to, and most of them didn't know anything about it. That we, the people, the citizens, needed to come together. And we, so, you know, first I had about a dozen of these military witnesses, then 40, then 100. Now we've identified over 400 or 500 of them. And what I've concluded is that this has to be very grassroots. And you know, people say, when is disclosure going to happen? I said, we're doing it. And, you know, don't think that the president of the United States is, because, you know, it's like Jimmy Carter said, he didn't have a high enough clearance to get read into and briefed on this stuff. So we have to find creative ways to do this. But the real thing that grabbed me, and I have to tell you this, my great love, and I was not raised in a religious family, but my big spiritual experience as a teenager was the great love I had for Earth and for Gaia, if you want to call it. And when I realized that the sciences and technologies and the energy generation systems that could give us an entirely new civilization without pollution or poverty were being ruthlessly withheld by a misanthropic bunch of sociopaths, I just said, look, you know, as much as it's been very painful leaving medicine, but I sort of look at the Earth now that all of us need to view the Earth as needing our help. She's our patient, and we have to heal her and heal ourselves in doing so.
This is an amazing couple weeks, too, for the UFO field, Stephen. Of course, with the release of your documentary, Sirius, and then next week, our old pal Stephen Bassett starts his citizen hearings in Washington, D.C. There's a lot going on here. It's got to be just a matter of time before this really cracks wide open, don't you think?
Right. And, you know, in fact, on the first night of those hearings, I'm going to be speaking at the National Press Club. This is the 12-year anniversary of the Disclosure Project National Press Club event in 2001. And we're going to be showing the entire film, Sirius, there for anyone who wants to come, although there's limited seating, and it's open to the public without charge. And what we're trying to do with that is to educate the media as well in Washington and the political folks in Washington. And, you know, there's some people, like there's a very fine gentleman who is one of President Carter's ambassadors who's a friend of mine who's coming. And I think it's going to be a really important event in terms of focusing Washington on this subject.
So important. Stephen, stay with us. We're going to come back with you and Paula. We're going to continue talking a couple hours here about the serious documentary, This Little Creature, whatever it may be. We're going to be joined in a moment as well with one of the lead researchers, Dr. Gary Nolan from Stanford University. We're going to get his take on this. He has examined this specimen. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Dr. Stephen Greer and Paula Harris. And in a moment here, we're going to bring in Dr. Gary Nolan. Stephen, I want you to tell us a little bit about Dr. Nolan, if you will, how you found him, and we'll bring him on for just a little bit. He's got a few minutes to spend with us. Go ahead, Stephen.
Well, you know, Dr. Nolan approached us after he heard that we had found this unusual specimen, as we call it. And, of course, he's the Harris Chair at the School of Medicine at Stanford University, a highly respected PhD scientist, one of the preeminent people in his field in the world. And we're really honored to have him available to work on this. Now, of course, he's approaching this that this is some kind of a human that has some kind of defect, and which is how, you know, we want him to approach it, as well as when Dr. Lockman has looked at it, is that it needs to be looked at, well, this is a human, let's see what we find, rather than going within any kind of preconceived ideas. And so he's an excellent scientist, and I think that when you look at the research he's done, it's just been impeccably done, because he has run exactly the kind of research lab that you need to be studying what's called ancient or older DNA. We don't know how old this little creature is, but it's at least decades to centuries old. And so it's a very special protocol to do the kind of research on that DNA than, say, something you take from yourself right now while you're living. And so he consulted and has worked with the top people in the world to do this properly. And so he's just doing a spectacular job.
Okay, well, let's bring him in, Dr. Gary Nolan. Gary, thanks for spending some moments here with us. I appreciate it.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You would love to prove that the creature is human, but as far as what you've done so far, are you pretty well convinced whatever it is, it was once alive, or it was once a real type of a, you know, biological specimen?
So let me actually just in a good way correct the first thing there that you said, where you said I'd love to prove that it's human. I don't want to prove that it's human. I think that it is very, very, very likely to be human, and I want to really get to the truth of the matter.
Fair enough.
And when I entered this with Stephen and his team, the idea was certainly not to come in with any presupposed expectations of what it would be, and that through the study, I would attempt to leave no stone unturned in the analysis of this. Now, I think that to this point, the data that we have is basically pointing as strong as possible, or as much as you could imagine at this point, that it is human. But as I relayed in the film, and as I've had discussions offline with Stephen, when you have something which does not really conform to expectations, you want to make sure that you do leave no stone unturned. And in the case of this, where we have DNA which is perhaps left over in the analysis because of the way that the computer programs are designed, we want to make sure that, as I've said in the film and otherwise, we're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Now, this creature, 6 inches tall, speculation that it's 6 to 8 years old, can you confirm that?
Yes. So, I can't confirm the age. I can confirm what the time that I spent with Dr. Lockman going over the analyses of the x-rays, what his conclusion was, that it was most likely to be 6 to 8 years old. What you have really is a paradox, right? You've got a specimen, a presumed young child, let's say. Let's not go unearthly at this point.
Okay.
That is only 6 inches long, right? And so that, of course, calls into question the age and would put the age at some, you know, at least if you used length as the measurement, you'd say that it is, you know, some very young preterm birth, right? But then when you start looking at the bone density, the first frank issue is that the bone density, irrespective of the epiphyseal plates, tells you that there's something a little bit odd, right? And so I'm, of course, not a specialist in this, but when Dr. Luckman, who is a specialist, looked at it and he pulled out the standards that he uses and that people would use in forensic analyses of these, of let's say, a dead child found, let's say, the surprise was, and it was his conclusion, certainly not mine, that the epiphyseal plates would suggest that it was 6 to 8 years old. So here you have a contradiction.
Right? It sure is. Well, here's an example. You know, I've got a little five-year-old grandson. Mm-hmm. He plays hockey. He runs. He does. He's 5 years old. He talks. He's about 3 feet tall. And, you know, he does whatever a little human being does. So are we saying that this creature was alive when it was around 6 or 8 years old? Keep in mind, my grandson's five, but it was 6 inches tall, so it's possible that it was walking around and doing things, but it was that small?
Yes. Steve, you go ahead if you'd like.
Yeah, what I want to comment, because I'm a clinical doctor, medical doctor, is that when you have the epiphyseal plates presenting as they do in the bone density, it does require that there be that it be somewhat ambulatory and that it is developing its long bones being the legs and arms and what have you. So, you know, we can't say, well, we know for a fact it was walking around and this and that. But the reality of it is that it's not a fetus. And this brings up exactly what Dr. Nolan's mentioning, and that is, how do you square the circle where you have a 6-inch intact organism that is absolutely not a hoax? And I think Gary will agree that this is a biological organism.
It is absolutely not a hoax.
So it's absolutely not a hoax. And the world's expert in the skeletal matter says it's a 6 to 8 year old. And then keep in mind that other radiologists, such as Dr. Manchon in Barcelona, who runs the Manchon Clinic, has said that it absolutely is not a fetus and that it lived for some years because of the bone density and the epiphyseal plate. So this is not something really in that big a dispute. Now, but when you start, then speculating that it was running around or doing this and that, we just have to say, well, I mean, assuming that it was ambulatory, which there's no reason to believe it wasn't, then yes, it would be. But, of course, it's only, it's a tiny, tiny fragile. I mean, it fits completely in my hands. Well, of course, I have size 9 hands.
but it's still little. It's still small.
But I think,
we were sweating bullets taking the clippings off the right anterior rib. We thought we were going to shatter the whole thing.
I think, though, to round out the discussion on it, as I said before, there's a paradox, right? You've got, on the one hand, it's too small to match with the apparent age. So that's when you start to ask if genetics is perhaps an answer, right? So you've probably heard, and I think your audience will have heard, of things like progeria, rapid aging disease, or at least apparent aging disease. So what you could speculate, and I feel comfortable speculating this, you could speculate that you've got a mutation which causes some kind of rapid bone aging disease, that the infant was in fact very young, but it had a rapid bone aging disease. Now, I can say that. It's not outside of the range of possibility, but it's never been seen before. So if it is that, right, let's say that we can eventually discover a gene or a set of genes that might be the case, and I could recreate the mutation in a mouse and prove that something like this was happening in a mouse model, then great, then that's the answer. But right now, I don't know what it is. So the real answer, or at least an answer to do, is to see if there's an alternative means that we can break the tie. Right? Is there something that says some alternative means to measure the age of the specimen that would support one side or the other? Now, a possibility that comes to mind is to measure the length of the telomeres, right? If the telomeres could be the, you know, could be used as an index of the age of the organism, your telomeres at the end of your chromosomes get shorter as you age. But that has never been done to age a specimen this young. Standards don't exist, and it might be that the, you know, the DNA fragmentation and the aging of the specimen itself would ruin the potential to use the telomeres as such.
And Dr. Nolan, for
the other thing, if I can just comment I just want you to comment on this. You've looked at the genes that would normally control for progeria, you know, advanced aging of bones, or the known forms of dwarfism, and you're not finding anything.
Right. No, there's no mutations there. But again, I think there's another thing that the listeners should really appreciate is that mutation in genetics is a very strange thing. There's always another strange mutation around the corner. There's always another one-off combination of mutations that could occur to cause a given disorder or disease. So just because I don't find a set of genes or one or two genes that might be suggestive of being the disorder doesn't mean that, again, it has an unearthly origin.
Gary, in terms of the skeletal composition, how old is a human fetus got to be to have that kind of skeletal composition as we find in this creature?
I actually wish I could answer that. That really is something that for Dr. Lockman.
Okay.
It's just not my area. I'm sorry.
Stephen, would you know?
Well, it's the size in terms of length of perhaps a, you know, 15 to 22-week fetus, depending on, you know, what condition it may have, which is a very, you know, pretty early a fetus in terms of what you would normally expect for something of this size, if you're speaking of just purely the size of the specimen.
Okay, and Gary, lastly, what can you tell us about the head? The head portion seems elongated.
Right, but I mean, it seems elongated, but there are, you know, upon drying, for instance, there could have been something that went on with the bone plates. You know, all I know is that, again, when Dr. Lockman commented on it, he did not comment on it in a way that suggested he knew what the genetics was that could lead to the structure. He basically just said, yes, this is unusual.
It is, and, truly.
Well, yes, and I think actually in his report, if you go to our website, seriousdisclosure.com, the report is there. He says that there are no known forms of dwarfism known that he has ever seen that would conform to the findings. And one of the most astonishing findings was that there are 10 ribs. Well, there have never been 10 ribs reported in any known human dysplasia skeletal form. And he made particular note of that. Correct me if I'm wrong, Gary.
No. And I want as well people to appreciate having read a fair amount of commentary this afternoon that already is ongoing about the 9 to 10% unmatched DNA. And I think, again, if you go back to the report that is on the Sirius website, there's a very clear explanation of what that 10% could mean. 10% unmatched DNA does not mean that it is viable sequence. There's any of a number of reasons why DNA sequences could be put in the trash bin, if you will. During the preparation of the DNA, you can get all kinds of artifacts, and the reads can be bad. But again, everything that went into the bin is in the bin for a reason, but that's because it didn't match the known. And again, back to this issue of what I promised Stephen, was that I wasn't going to let other people's preconceptions define for me what I should accept about something that's unusual. So if something's in the bin, I have to go back in now and write algorithms literally to search through the millions of sequences there to basically confirm that everything that went in there for a good reason.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so maybe there'll be something left over. It's like I tell my students in a lab when we're going over data, you really shouldn't let some anomaly that stands out and you don't have a good reason for it sit unnoticed and unanswered.
Gary, I know you've got a very busy day tomorrow. I want to thank you for spending some time with us tonight absolutely riveting story. Whatever you need, you let us know, okay?
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Say hi to your mother for us.
All right.
His mother is an avid listener, Stephen, to Coast to Coast. But
oh, good. I didn't know that. Well, I learn something new every day.
I've got to tell you, looking at this specimen, it looks like a tiny little alien gray. It's got the elongated head. It's got the big eye sockets.
Yeah, one of the things that was noted is that the and I've done a measurement on this, the distance from the eye socket up to the top of the head is around three times in terms of the volume of what ours is. And what does this suggest? So normally a very large cranium and that is associated with very advanced intelligence, et cetera, and so on. Now, we don't know that in this case, but it does conform. Now, I'm putting out my hat on not only as a medical doctor, but as someone who has studied the UFO subject. And I'm going to tell you something even more explosive. In 1996, I was called into a case before the FSB, which was the KGB, confiscated it, of a little being that was in Russia named the Alexis being. And you know what? It has four bones, skull bones, just like this creature has, a very similar head, very small creature. I've seen video and photograph of it recently. And unfortunately, that one ended up disappearing before we could get any CAT scans or genetic material from it, because that was 1996. But if there are two of these, and this is why I think, you know, what Dr. Nolan and I've talked about is that we can't say it is anything at this point. We can't say it's ET. On the other hand, if you go to that part of the Atacama Desert, you hear reports of people seeing these luminous objects going into the foothills of the Andes.
That's right.
You hear reports of the native people seeing these small, very tiny human-like creatures that have been seen moving around. And so what we need to do, I mean, of course, we don't have the funds for this, but it's to do a really serious research expedition to the Atacama Desert in Chile with ground-penetrating radar, ultrasound, archaeologists, and what have you, because the team in Barcelona that is possessing this creature did go there, and they didn't have enough research funds, but they got these accounts from people and also got accounts that there may be more of these in sort of burial sites and urns in that part of Chile. If true, then that precludes it being a one-off mutation.
That's
so this is something that we can't say anything for sure yet, but it just needs more and more thorough research, which is really what we've been trying to do with Disclosure Project all along, and putting together the best radar tapes and the best photographs and the best top secret witness testimony. And now this thing comes across my desk. And so, you know, we're doing the best we can, and I know it's created a lot of controversy. We're being very careful to say, you know, we really don't know what it is right now, but it's not a hoax, it's not a fetus, and it is something very unusual.
Well, and here's one thing we know for sure. It's not a little Hollywood model made out of something. It's it's a biological entity of some type.
It's a total biological entity never seen before. And what's significant about that is that if it was just any doctor who said that, it'd be one thing. But when the world's expert at Stanford University, who wrote the textbook of these sort of skeletal abnormalities, Dr. Lockman says it, people need to sit up and take notice.
It actually looks, just on the pictures I've seen on your website, perfectly developed.
It is, and it's symmetrical. That's the only asymmetry in the entire being, and this is unusual. Usually when you have deformities like a club foot or this and that, you do see a lot of asymmetry and obvious defects. This is a perfect little specimen, except that it has a fracture of the right arm and a fracture behind the back of the right skull, which I think was the cause of its death, and as Dr. Lockman. And in fact, we had a medical pathologist this weekend look at it also and look at the x-rays, and she concluded the same thing, that it died of some kind of traumatic blow to the head and right side of its body.
Dramatic story. Stephen, we're going to take some phone calls with you and Paula Harris when we come back in just a moment. Of course, all the websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Paula Harris's website, of course, and Dr. Stephen Greer. And if you haven't had an opportunity yet to look at these pictures or this documentary, the serious documentary, please go ahead and do that. You are in for a treat. We'll be back in a moment with your calls on Coast to Coast AM.